Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CueAndReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CueAndReview.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of March 2024, from the news section. Four people swept up in human-triggered avalanche in Cairngorms. This article is written by Ross Hunter. Four people have been rescued after being caught up in a human-triggered avalanche in the Cairngorms. The Scottish Avalanche Information Service, SAIS, said a group of five people were involved in the incident near Cairngorm on Tuesday. According to the SAIS, the avalanche occurred in Syst Merned, to the east of Tarman, while a group were taking part in winter skills training course. A group of five people were involved, three were carried down and one buried to the waist, thankfully without injury, an SAIS spokesperson told the Inverness Courier. Syst Merned always accumulates snow in westerly and southwesterly winds due to the fetch of the plateau. This makes the location a reliable and snow-sure spot for snow-holing and winter skills parties, but it is also steep. There have been two avalanches reported here this season. Thanks to both parties for reporting these events, while nobody would want to advertise the fact, events like these provide SAIS with useful confirmation of stability, or instability. It comes after two climbers were airlifted to hospital from Ben Nevis last week, after one was caught in an avalanche while another fell on a nearby mountain. One suffered a nasty leg fracture, while the other escaped uninjured. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of March 2024, from the news section. Hundreds leave homes in Aberdeen after wrack concrete discovery. This article is written by Ross Hunter. Hundreds of people are being moved out of their homes in Aberdeen after structural engineers found they contained collapse-risk concrete. Panels made from reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, RAC, were found in about 500 homes in the Balnegask area of Aberdeen, including 364 council properties last year. An independent structural engineer's report on the presence of RAC in a representative sample of the properties recommended that council tenants be relocated to alternative accommodation within the city as soon as possible. The authority received the report on February the 22nd, and it was considered by Aberdeen City Council's Urgent Business Committee on Thursday, February the 29th. Councillors accepted a recommendation from council officers that tenants be permanently rehomed and have written to council tenants as well as to owners and private tenants to update them on the situation. Miranda Radley, convener of the Communities Housing and Public Protection Committee, said, "This is an incredibly difficult situation for everyone living in a RAC-affected property, but the council will be doing everything we can to support our tenants during this hugely challenging time. These are people's homes, and we need to ensure we support our tenants, but also engage with owners and privately rented tenants to keep them informed on this matter." The council said that 299 of the 364 council properties are currently occupied by council tenants, and the remaining 140 of the 500 or so properties affected are privately owned. Officials are currently exploring options for the long-term viability of the site, which include remedial works or demolition, and a detailed appraisal will be presented to the council within 6 months. The council has written to council tenants, inviting them to meet with the housing and support officer in their home. It has also contacted owners and private tenants to let them know the current position, and to offer them a meeting with the housing and support officer to discuss their housing options. The committee has agreed to set aside an initial £3 million to cover the rehoming programme. Concerns about RAAC emerged last year, prompting governments and councils around the UK to assess buildings for its presence. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024, from the news section. Jobs at risk as Scottish family-run furniture firm goes bust. This article is written by James Walker. A family-run furniture retailer has gone bust, with multiple jobs at risk. Based in Glasgow, Morale Home Furnishings is a retailer of furniture and homewares, as well as garden furniture and accessories. The company, which is run by businessman Khalid Ali and his family, was reportedly impacted by customers moving to lower-priced alternatives, including those retailers which predominantly sell online. The company employs 6 employees, all of which will be retained while the company is in administration. Blair Nimmo and Alastair McAllendon from Interpath Advisory were appointed joint administrators to the Morale Home Furnishings UK Limited on February the 28th, 2024. Following their appointment, the joint administrators announced they will continue to trade the business for a period and, as such, have commenced a closing down sale at the store in the Hillington Industrial Estate, Glasgow. The sale will initially see discounts of at least 30% off recommended retail price on all stock and up to 60% off RRP on selected lines on display furniture straight from the showroom. Alastair McAllendon, head of Interpath Advisory in Scotland and joint administrator, said, "As consumers continue to tighten their belts as a result of the cost of living crisis, retailers of big ticket items and similar considered purchases continue to come under significant pressure." Alastair McAllendon said, "Our intention is to trade the business for a short period while we seek to sell all remaining stock, so we'd encourage customers to visit the store over the coming days, where Morale's team of dedicated employees will be available to assist." That article was written by James Walker. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024, from the news section. New plans to dismantle Rosyth nuclear submarines left for decades. This article is written by Ali McRoberts. There are plans for a new building at Rosyth Dockyard to dismantle the old nuclear submarines that are stored there. Babcock International has applied to Fife Council for permission to construct a large steel shed at Dry Dock No. 2. If approved, it will be 70 metres long, 18 metres wide and 20 metres high, and aid dismantling operations at the yard, where 7 old subs have been laid up for decades. A separate planning application related to the project for a metal waste disposal facility at the corner of Wood Road and Caledonia Road was submitted to the council late last year. Blyth and Blyth of Edinburgh have been appointed by Babcock as civil and structural engineering consultants for the Rosyth submarine dismantling project and are agents for both applications. The last of the subs at the dockyard came out of service in 1996, and Dreadnought has been there the longest, coming up for 44 years. Laid up in Rosyth since 1980, longer than it was in service, getting rid of it and the six other vessels is part of a pledge given in 2022 by the UK government to Fife Council to denuclearise Rosyth by 2035. Councillors were also told of a world first, with plans to take out the reactor, the most radioactive part, before cutting up the ships, with the overall ambition of turning them into razor blades and tin cans. Most of the low-level radioactive waste should be gone from Rosyth by the end of this year. Documents submitted with the latest planning application says that the new building would be 1,162 square metres in size. The site is currently an area of hard standing, used for the external storage of materials and equipment associated with the refurbishment of vessels in the dry dock. Waste produced from the dismantling process shall be processed in other existing buildings within the dock facilities. In total, the UK has 27 old Royal Navy submarines to be scrapped. Others are stored at Devonport, and the UK government has been heavily criticised for delays in dealing with the nuclear legacy. Maintaining the vessels costs £30 million a year. That article was written by Ali McRoberts. This is from The National on Friday, the 1st of March, 2024, from the Culture section. Scots poet Len Penny's first collection becomes bestseller. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The debut poetry collection of a Scots writer who shot to fame on social media has hit the bestseller charts. Len Penny's anthology entitled Poems received more than 5,000 pre-orders, with nearly 500 copies already being sold at Publication Week events across Scotland. As a result, it has reached number 2 on the UK's non-fiction bestseller list. Speaking to the Herald, Penny thanked Scots-speaking communities for preserving and celebrating the language. "To hit bestseller lists with my debut collection is such an incredible feeling. So many of the topics addressed in poems, like domestic abuse and mental illness, thrive in the silence and isolation of those experiencing them, and I wanted to write a book that helped others realise they weren't alone. More than anything, Poems is a book about connection, and I am incredibly grateful to everyone who has helped it find its community, from my agent and publisher to the readers and booksellers who've been so generous in their support. I couldn't have written Poems without the Scots-speaking communities who have preserved, protected and celebrated Scots, especially my family, to whom I am forever grateful." The 24-year-old gained popularity after her poem, "I'm No Having Children," went viral in 2020. It is now featured as the last poem in her debut collection. After successful launch events in Edinburgh, Glasgow, St Andrews and Dollar, Penny is now off to promote the book in England and Wales. Helena Gonda, senior commissioning editor at Canongate, said, "It's been incredible to see the rising demand for Lenny's debut collection across the board, and particularly gratifying to be launching her straight to number 2 on the bestseller list. Although deeply personal, her poems have a timeless universality, and we're thrilled with the response from readers so far." That article was written by Ross Hunter.
This is from The National on Monday, 4th March 2024. From the Politics section. Calls for inquiry as children made to play foster care game. By Adam Robertson. Social workers and foster families are calling for an independent inquiry after it emerged staff employed by the Home Office forced refugee children to play a game to guess who would be the next one to be placed in foster care. In a letter published by The Guardian, the British Association of Social Workers, the Fostering Network, the Refugee Council, and Every Child Protected Against Trafficking are among 20 bodies saying children are being failed due to the current Home Office system. The letter reads, "In our work with refugee children, we repeatedly see how they are being failed. Hundreds of unaccompanied children missing from hotels still have not been found. Children systematically wrongly aged assessed are treated as adults and placed in the same bedrooms as unrelated adult strangers. There is a culture of callous disregard for children's basic right to dignity. It is time for the government to carry out a wide-ranging independent inquiry into the treatment of unaccompanied children who come to our country seeking safety." The Home Office launched its own internal inquiry after the game was disclosed on Thursday by a report on unaccompanied asylum-seeking children written by the sacked Borders watchdog, David Neil. An inspector working for Neil at one of the four hotels where dozens of children were living was shocked to hear they were gathered together when one of their number was to be placed with a foster family. The report said, "One team leader described the process by which they would disclose to the children who would be the next to leave for a placement. This involved making a game of it, asking them to guess who would be next before revealing their name. Inspectors considered this to be insensitive in the extreme and undoubtedly upsetting the children. In the re-inspection of four hotels where children were being housed, the Borders inspector found there was no guarantee staff were given regular disclosure and barring services clearances. In evidence to the re-inspection, the Home Office reported 147 children had left the hotels without supervision and remained unaccounted for between July 2021 and September 8, 2023. Neil was sacked as Independent Inspector of Borders and Immigration after disclosing details of some 15 reports that he had submitted up to 11 months ago. 13 of the reports, totalling 900 pages, were released on Thursday, the same day as the Sarah Everard Report, Immigration Statistics and a National Audit Office, revealing the cost of the Rwanda scheme. It led to Labour accusing the Home Office of attempting to bury bad news. A spokesperson for the Home Office said, "The safety and welfare of unaccompanied asylum-seeking children is our utmost priority. After the inspection's findings, we launched a full investigation into the inappropriate behaviour of the support worker who was removed from the site immediately and did not return. Since the two independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration inspections in 2022 and 2023, we have closed all seven hotels used to accommodate unaccompanied asylum-seeking children." That article was by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Monday, 4th March 2024, from the News section. Forestry and Land Scotland hits 10,000 hectares of peatland restoration. By Laura Pollock. The Scottish Government body that manages Scotland's forests has set 10,000 hectares of peatland on the road to recovery through re-wetting sites. The milestone has been reached by Forestry and Land, or FLS, staff and contractors working on sites across Scotland, including at Kintyre and Lochaber in the west, Carnwath and Flanders Moss in central Scotland, and Skye and Flow Country in Caithness and Sutherland in the north. It is estimated, when fully recovered, the 10,000 hectares will permanently bring about emissions savings of 87,800 tonnes of CO2 per year, the equivalent of taking about 63,000 new petrol cars in the UK off the road for a year. It comes after several FLS forest to bog peatland projects featured in the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's recent paper as an example of successful restoration. The Scottish Government currently has a target of restoring 250,000 hectares of degraded peatland by 2030. Peatlands cover around 2 million hectares, or a quarter of Scotland, and when healthy can help secure carbon stores by changing them from sources of carbon to carbon sinks, while also supporting nature and reducing flood and fire risk. Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Land Reform and Islands, Mary Gudgeon, said, "Peatlands are an integral part of Scotland's cultural and natural heritage and cover more than 20% of our country. When in good condition, they can help us fight climate change, support biodiversity, improve water quality, and reduce the severity of flooding and fires. I'm proud to mark FLS hitting 10,000 hectares of peatland restoration. Every site we restore adds to the scale of the contribution we make to our environment, to biodiversity, water quality, to our future, and to the people of Scotland. Work is continuing to restore and protect the next 10,000 hectares of this precious natural resource, and this will play a key part in Scotland's response to the twin crises of climate change and biodiversity loss." FLS Chief Executive Simon Hodgson said, "Reaching this milestone is a testament to the dedication of FLS teams and our partners in efforts to transform and restore one of Scotland's largest degraded ecosystems to create a far healthier landscape. One that not only benefits the wider environment, but also the health and well-being of people and nature." That article was by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Monday, 4th March 2024, from the News section. Poll shows more than three quarters of Scots limit energy use amid cost crisis. By Lucinda Cameron. Three quarters of people in Scotland have limited their energy use to afford other goods and services, including food, in the last year, according to new research. The Servation poll for Advice Direct Scotland found that more than half, or 57%, are worried about being able to afford electricity, gas, or oil over the coming year. It found that 76% of adults in Scotland have either slightly or significantly limited their energy use over the past 12 months so they can pay for other goods and or services, including food. Half, 50%, said they sometimes feel cold in their own home as a result, and a further 24% said they often feel cold. Advice Direct Scotland said the UK's energy market is broken, with many worried about how they will be able to pay for energy in the year ahead. The charity is calling on the UK government to use Wednesday's budget to introduce an opt-out social tariff, which would automatically put struggling households on the cheapest deal. Andrew Bartlett, Chief Executive of Advice Direct Scotland, said, "This poll indicates that hundreds of thousands of Scots are limiting their energy use so they can afford to pay for other goods such as food and are left suffering in the cold in their own homes as a result. For those on prepayment meters, the cost of energy has left many unable to afford a top-up, often leaving people in debt. While bills might have fallen from their recent peak, they still remain high, and a majority of Scots are worried about being able to afford this over the coming year. These findings confirm that the UK's energy market is broken, and we need an opt-out social energy tariff to help the most vulnerable households. This has widespread public support, and the Chancellor should use this week's budget to act." Advice Direct Scotland said that while regulator Ofgem will drop its cap on the amount suppliers are able to charge by £1,928 to £1,690 from April 1st, this is still £552 more than what households were charged before the energy crisis hit in the autumn of 2021. A poll of 1,043 Scots aged over 16 carried out in February found that just over 1 in 10, or 11%, said they are behind on their energy bills, with some struggling with debts of more than £1,000. More than half of those with a prepayment meter, 57%, said the cost of energy has often or sometimes caused them to run out of funds to keep it topped up. Two-thirds, 66%, of those questioned said they would support the UK-wide introduction of a social tariff. The charity said a social energy tariff could be targeted at those most in need, with eligibility being determined by whether members of the household are in receipt of benefits or are on low incomes. Advice Direct Scotland runs energyadvice.scot, which provides free, practical advice and information on energy-related matters, and can be accessed at www.energyadvice.scot. A Department for Energy Security and Net Zero spokesperson said, "We recognise the cost of living challenges families are facing, which is why we are spending £104 billion supporting households with their bills. A social tariff is about protecting vulnerable people, and that's exactly what we are doing by providing significant financial support for those who need it most. This includes £900 in cost of living payments, £150 to those on eligible disability benefits, plus a further £150 warm home discount." That article was by Lucinda Cameron. This is from The National on Monday, 4th March 2024, from the Politics section. Scotland facing decade of damaging austerity cuts, by Abby Garton Crosby. Scotland is facing another decade of devastating austerity cuts, the SNP have warned, as the UK government looks to set a damaging spring budget. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt told broadcasters on Sunday that he hopes to show a path in the direction of tax cuts, but ruled out using borrowing to fill any funding gaps. Opposition politicians, charities and lobbyists have been setting out their asks of the UK government ahead of the budget announcement on Wednesday. Scotland's Finance Secretary, Shona Robinson, urged Hunt not to cut taxes, while Social Justice Secretary Shirley Ann Somerville called on the Chancellor to tackle poverty and remove several damaging policies, such as the two-child benefit cap. However, all Hunt would hint at during the Sunday broadcast round was that any cuts to taxes would be sustainable and affordable. It has been suggested that a further cut to national insurance contributions could be on the table. I do want, where it is possible to do so responsibly, to move towards a lower tax economy, and I hope to show a path in that direction, Hunt told the BBC's Sunday with Laura Kunzberg programme. This will be a prudent and responsible budget for long-term growth, tackling inflation, more investment, more jobs, and that path to lower taxation as and when we can afford that. The Chancellor told Sky News the 2p cut to national insurance in the autumn statement in November was a turning point, and he hopes to make some progress on that journey. Hunt's comments were met with calls by the SNP for further investment in the NHS of £15 billion and introducing a wealth tax to fund public services and capital investment. The UK is fast heading towards another damaging decade of Westminster austerity cuts unless the Tories and Labour Party scrap their economically illiterate fiscal rules and prioritise investment in public services and economic growth over devastating cuts, Drew Henry, MP, SNP economy spokesperson, said. Westminster has already slashed Scotland's budget by more than £2 billion this year and imposed real cuts to the NHS across the UK. The Chancellor must ditch his reckless plans for even more cuts before it's too late. Henry called for investment in public services rather than cutting them to the bone, adding that the UK is now in a doom spiral of ever deeper cuts. Instead of cutting off capital investment, the SNP is calling on the Chancellor to go for growth by investing at least £28 billion a year in green energy and rejoining the EU single market. That is the only credible path to sustained growth, he added. The next general election will be a clear choice between the pro-growth SNP and the pro-cuts Tories and Labour Party. Unlike Sunak and Starmer, the SNP will stand up for Scotland's values, demand NHS investment, help with the cost of living, and the choice of a better future with independence. It comes as Deputy First Minister Robinson told BBC Scotland the spring budget should prioritise investment in public services over tax cuts. Robinson told BBC Scotland's Sunday show that along with bodies such as the International Monetary Fund and the Office for Budget Responsibility, she shares the view that the spring budget should prioritise investment in public services, not tax cuts. She said, "All of these organisations have said the same, that tax cuts are unaffordable, and indeed it is the investment in public services that are needed. I agree with that, and I really hope that Wednesday will see a change in the direction that Jeremy Hunt takes, particularly on investment on capital, so that we can invest in our infrastructure, things like affordable housing, for example. So those are the key priorities that I and many others are calling on Jeremy Hunt to prioritise." Robinson also called for the £1.6 billion real terms cut to the Scottish Government's capital budget over the next 5 years to be reversed. Elsewhere, in a letter to the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, Mel Stride, Scotland's Social Justice Secretary called for an essentials guaranteed to be introduced so that those on benefits have enough to meet their basic needs. Somerville added that this alone would not be enough, and damaging measures such as the bedroom tax, two council benefit cap and sanctions would need to be scrapped. These policies restrict the amount of support available to some of our most vulnerable people, disproportionately affecting women and children, and build unnecessary hardship into the social security system, she wrote. Somerville urged the UK government to follow Scotland's lead and focus on tackling child poverty. That article was by Abby Garton Crosby.
From the National, Monday the 4th of March, from the comment section, UK government's put industrial strategy on the scrap heap. Article by Douglas Chapman. I couldn't have put it better than Lord Mandelson when he described the UK economy as being stuck in a fearful hole. The former Labour Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills was appearing at a Business and Trades Committee session at Westminster to scrutinise the UK government's industrial strategy, or lack of one, you could say. Lord Mandelson was joined by former Secretary of State for Business in the Tory/Lib Dem coalition, Vince Cable, and Greg Clark MP as former Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy between 2016 and 2019, when the UK government still had an industrial approach before ditching it under the chaos of Boris Johnson. Quite an illustrious cast, with Lord Hannington also present, author of the independent review commissioned by the government into UK approach to foreign direct investment. It was one of those committee sessions where the absolute horror of Tory mismanagement of our economy and international reputation was once again laid out in all its disastrous consequences for real people living real lives across the UK. And another example of how we have had one of the worst possible governments during one of the most challenging periods in our history, as we grapple with Brexit, the global pandemic, war in Europe, and now the Middle East, climate change, and, of course, the trailing arm of the devastation of the financial crash. It's hard to find positive in this quagmire, while at the same time a relief to listen to a group of former cross-party ministers who have the knowledge and the expertise required to analyse what has gone wrong, even if our political viewpoints differ. Recurring themes of a lack of consistency on policy, stability or long-term commitments, confusing financial advice, and government silos creating an environment where it is impossible for a joined-up and strategic approach, impossible for private investment to navigate, and thus equally impossible for business confidence to grow. This haphazard approach makes it even harder for the UK to rise successfully to the challenge of major transitions in green and digital technologies and societal issues, such as regional inequality. Meanwhile, the UK bumps down to near the very bottom of the G7 nations, and low capital investment leads to low productivity growth. Sounds a lot like more than a mere technical recession to me. It's always interesting to be facing a group of weighty witnesses that all still adhere to a better together approach for Scotland and the UK, even when they are describing the wholesale destruction or, worse, lack of interest in economic prosperity and success since the 2014 referendum. It's hard to find any aspect of things being better for Scotland to be tethered to an ad hoc, unstable, ever-changing cycle of policy flip-flops that even the Institute for Government describes as missing in action when it comes to certainty and longevity, the policy attributes that businesses value most. Greg Clark noted that his party and government seem to take a surreptitious approach to industrial policy, where having an undercover strategy, i.e. an industrial policy that is not an industrial policy, is rather self-defeating. Not content with the instability of a revolving door of prime ministers, the Tory government has also been busy getting dizzy with the government department responsible for managing industrial policy being reorganised 5 times over 15 years with 15 different secretaries of state responsible for business and industrial strategy in the same time period, as Make UK points out in its recent report on industrial strategy and manufacturing ambition. hardly strong and stable, not exactly the best way to build back better, and certainly not the ideal vehicle to realise any of the much discussed levelling up goals to deal with glaring inequalities between the southeast of England and the rest of the UK, not least Scotland. Meanwhile, our global neighbour's industrial success has been motivated by a desire to realise our economic strategic competitiveness and tackle the epic challenge of climate change, with US President Joe Biden introducing major industrial policy legislation such as the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS and Science Act, and the EU announcing its Green Industrial Plan and Net Zero Industry Act. The UK remains the outlier, with the Tory government pretending we don't need to get in the act, despite organisations like the World Economic Forum revealing that three quarters of the chief economists they surveyed expect industrial policy to become a widespread global approach to the economic policy over the next 3 years. So, while we're stuck in this fearful hole, other countries are steaming ahead with joined-up, pragmatic and far-reaching industrial strategies, where government intervention is not regarded as a business faux pas, but an essential component of a partnership and cooperation model with industry experts for the good of their respective economies. Just last month, I raised an early day motion in support of the FM's call for an industrial strategy once we are independent. I went one step further and called for Scotland to go ahead in the here and now and establish a Minister for Industrial Strategy, to use every devolved lever possible to create a more resilient and proactive environment for economic success and prosperity. Being independent, of course, would give us far more scope for the success, but we've no time to lose to make the most of our innovative opportunities, the green transition, our abundant natural resources, and the chance to create a truly skilled and diverse workforce. I think Scotland has all the right attributes, experience and talent to get us out of this fearful hole, and I don't think we need to wait until there's been a change in government at Westminster to make it happen, especially given Labour's prevarications on their commitment to the green transformation and their Brexit blind spot. The Better Together bubble was burst 10 years ago, when promises made were never realised. But the important thing to remember is that Scotland is not on her own. There's a whole international community out there getting fit for the future and building their industrial capability. Why can't we? And that was a comment piece by Douglas Chapman.
The National, recorded on Monday, 4th of March 2024. The Culture Section. Exclusive, Scottish comedian Zara Gladman discusses 10 things changed her life. By Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. Adam Robertson spoke with Scottish comedian Zara Gladman on the 10 things that changed her life. 1. The internet. It's maybe an obvious one, but I wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for the internet. I wouldn't be doing my comedy show, but even before the recent stuff, it had an impact on me when I was a teenager. I used to have a website, and I think it helped fuel a lot of the obsessions that I had growing up, whether it was music or comedy. There's a limitless amount of stuff online. It started impacting me as soon as I got it, and it's still having a huge impact now. 2. Zoology. I studied zoology at the University of Glasgow. Before I went to university, I was really quite quiet and shy, but when I got there, it was quite a formative time. I found other people with the same interests, and I think zoology in particular encouraged me to travel to new places. Even within Scotland, I grew up in Glasgow, so I was always a bit of a city kid, but zoology took me to Loch Lomond, to the north of Scotland. I went all over the place. I also made friends for life. I'm still close with people that I studied with, and it was zoology that led me into comedy. The first time I did stand-up, it was about crayfish, which I did my PhD on. 3. 2014 independence referendum. It politicised me. I was living in London when the Edinburgh Agreement was signed. I was working down there, but then I moved back not long after that. It was during the campaign I found the city completely changed. I think possibly as a result of the Indie Ref, there were all these pop-up events, music, poetry, comedy. There was an amazing sense of community and possibility, so I really got involved with that. And an amazing summer, and also my activism again encouraged me to start performing, because that was my way of contributing. I got so consumed by it, and it was such a devastating blow when we found out the result, that I actually gave up comedy not long after, and it's taken me a long time to come back to performing. So I think that whole period had a huge impact on me, on my politics, my performing, and my outlook. 4. The Beatles. I'm a Beatles obsessive. I have been since I was a teenager. My friend Katie and I at school used to watch videos of John Lennon at lunchtime and cry about him. We went to International Beatle Week together in Liverpool when we were 19. I'm still a huge fan now, but I actually don't listen to them that often. I take it personally when people slag them off because they're so fundamental to the fabric of my being. They were my adolescence, and when I do listen to them, I get very emotional. I saw Paul McCartney for the first time at Glastonbury in 2004, and I stood for 7 hours without eating or peeing so I could be at the front. They basically introduced me to music. I think when I was a teenager, I consumed such a huge volume of music, and I don't do that now, so when I do listen to stuff, it's not at the same volume. I listen to a lot of podcasts now. I do listen to music, but not at the same obsessed level. I think maybe that just happens as you get older, you get a bit fatigued with it all. I do think, when I listen to them, it takes me back and I have this emotional response. 5. Lockdown. This happened for me almost immediately after a breakup. So he moved out and then I spent lockdown on my own and wasn't able to do any of the things you'd normally do after a breakup, like go out and see your pals. It was such a strange time. I think maybe with the isolation, I started to go a bit mad. And so I channeled that energy into comedy. I was making silly videos, having not done any of that in years. It kind of pushed me into doing comedy again, and then I got into TikTok, and that's led me to where I am today. If lockdown hadn't happened, I don't know if I'd have done any of that. 6. The Lord of the Rings. These films have been a constant in my life since they came out. I watch them at least annually. They're kind of a comfort blanket, and I find they can be a useful barometer for me to judge if I'm going to get on with someone. If they're into these films, then we'll probably get on fine. On top of that, my biggest celebrity spot came in 2010 when I was in my local Sainsbury's in Partick and I saw Elijah Wood, Billy Boyd and Dominic Monaghan in the booze aisle. It was wild and it was Hugman A, so nobody was paying any attention. I still regret not saying anything. I just kind of looked at them and was like, oh my god, why are there hobbits in my Sainsbury's? 7. Smack the Pony. It's a sketch show for those that don't know. At the time, I didn't really think about the fact that it was female-led. I thought it was really funny. I loved the music videos. I loved the characters. I was obsessed with it and would watch it with my friends. It still stands up for me and it's mad to think it came out 20 years ago. I can't think of any equivalent long-running women-led sketch shows that have happened since then, so I think we need more of that. It was never in my radar to do comedy watching it. I just watched it as a young girl and saw these women being hilarious, and it's still one of my favourites. 8. Glasgow International Comedy Festival. It's kind of cheesy, but even though I haven't done my show yet, it's already had a big impact in me just being part of it all. It was the team there that gave me a confidence boost to go for it at the Oran Moor, which is an amazing venue for a first-timer. I got to hang out with Elaine C. Smith at the press launch, so even if my show bombs at this point, I've already had an amazing time. But the team are so supportive of new acts and they genuinely care about bringing up new acts. That's very cool and it makes me feel good to be a part of that. 9. Meadow Road's Morning Roll. Meadow Road is an amazing coffee shop. I visited a lot during lockdown. All of the staff are total legends, but my favourite thing that they do is the morning roll. It's actually vegan, even though I'm not. But I put square sausage, black pudding, tatty scone and a bit of ketchup on there. It's delicious and it saved my life after I've had a boozy night. It's a crispy Morton's roll as well, so that's essential because I love those and I was really nervous when it looked like those might disappear. It's the perfect roll and I'd recommend it to, even if you're not vegan, to give it a go. 10. My heated blanket. It's a total game changer if you're working from home. I hate the cold. When I was a student, I lived in a freezing damp tenement. And I just hated the cold in there. I've yet to live in a tenement that is warm. Maybe this is controversial because they're old and beautiful, but unless they're properly insulated, they're shit to live in. So that's my hot take. By Adam Robertson.
This is from The National, on Wednesday, the 6th of March, 2024. From the News and Politics section. Highland Energy boss quits SNP and joins ALBA in oil and gas row. Article by Ross Hunter, multimedia journalist. A Highland Energy boss and former SNP backer has joined ALBA, claiming that Alex Salmond's party is the only one standing up for the oil and gas industry. Steve Chisholm is the Operations and Innovations Director for the Global Energy Group, a leading service and contracting company for the energy sector. He is known as one of the driving forces behind the Inverness and Cromartie Green Freeport, coordinating with public bodies to develop a business case for the project. He told the Press and Journal that despite being a lifelong supporter of the SNP, he had taken the decision to leave due to the party's stance on oil and gas support. He said, "I'm a second generation supporter of the party. It's something that's been with me since I was in primary school. Because of that, it's not easy to walk away, but it's become slightly diluted and it's not the single purpose voice for independence it was a few years ago." Chisholm recently put his name forward to be the SNP candidate for Caithness, Sutherland and Easter Ross at the upcoming general election, which is currently held by Lib Dem Jamie Stone. He was beaten in the contest by Lucy Beattie, but said the process made him realise the SNP's business as usual approach wasn't meeting the needs of those in the Highlands. "I have joined ALBA as it is a real opportunity to be part of an ambitious party which is entirely focused on gaining Scottish independence," he said. "The Highlands possess a wealth of natural resources, resilient communities and a strong cultural heritage which should see our region prosper. Our region is pivotal in achieving targets for energy security and net zero. ALBA is the only party I see standing up for our oil and gas industry and its workers, recognising the importance of a gradual transition to renewable sources of energy." ALBA leader Alex Salmond welcomed Chisholm to the party and said his decision underscores the party's commitment to advocating for the interests of the Highlands. He added, "We are delighted to have someone of Steve's calibre and business experience on board. It emphasises ALBA's credentials as a truly national party, representing all parts and all communities in Scotland." ALBA's request to Steve Chisholm to help lead an economic and business initiative underscores the party's commitment to fostering economic growth and advocating for the interests of the Highlands. His extensive experience and dedication to the region's development position him as a valuable asset in shaping the party's economic policy and industrial strategy. It comes after a prominent member of ALBA left the party following a row over its gender recognition policy. That article was by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Wednesday, the 6th of March, 2024. From the News and Politics section. Public foot bill as Tory minister libels Scottish University academic. Article by Xander Elliards, content editor. A Tory cabinet secretary has been forced to pay damages to an academic at a Scottish university after making false allegations about her, with the taxpayer footing the bill. Technology Secretary Michelle Donnellan had accused Professor Kate Sang of Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh of having extremist views on Hamas and called for her to be fired from an Equality, Diversity and Inclusion panel. In October, in a letter sent to Chief Executive of UK Research and Innovation Ottoline Lesser, the Tory MP claimed both Sang and Dr. Kamna Patel of University College London had expressed extremist views on the Israel-Gaza conflict. Donnellan's letters to Lesser expressed disgust and outrage at Research England's appointment of individuals to an advisory group on equality, diversity and inclusion who have been sharing extremist views on social media. Now Donnellan has been forced to retract her comments and pay damages. A UKRI investigation found no evidence of support for a proscribed terrorist organisation or the sharing of extremist material, and no grounds to remove any individual members from the diversity panel. It also found no evidence of a breach of the panel's terms of reference and no failure to uphold the seven principles of public life, the Nolan principles. Donnellan has retracted her past comments, writing on social media, "I have never thought or claimed that Professor Sang or any member of the board committed a criminal offence. I fully accept that she is not an extremist, a supporter of Hamas or any other proscribed organisation, and I note that an independent investigation has concluded that there is no evidence that she is. I have deleted my original post to my X account." Joe Grady, the General Secretary of the University and College Union, said, This investigation completely exonerates our members and confirms Michelle Donnellan's unprecedented politicised intervention was an outrageous attack on academic freedom. Tamsin Allen, who represented Tsang in her legal action, said, Michelle Donnellan has now withdrawn her false allegations and agreed to pay damages and costs to Professor Tsang. Tsang said, I am delighted that this matter has now concluded, but very disturbed by the way in which Michelle Donnellan and UKRI behaved. Had they asked me from the start, I would have explained the true position. Instead, Michelle Donnellan made a cheap political point at my expense and caused serious damage to my reputation. I propose to donate part of the damages she has paid to a charity. The UK government's Department for Science, Innovation and Technology said it had paid the legal costs and damages, adding, this was subject to all the usual cross-government processes and aims to reduce the overall cost to the taxpayer that could result from protracted legal action. Reports say Downing Street has expressed support for Donnellan, so she is likely to remain in post. UKRI is a public body that directs research and innovation funding. Patel said, there was never any need for UKRI to investigate, as it should have been obvious from the start that we had not breached the Nolan principles or expressed extremist views. Worryingly, it appears UKRI were steered by who made the claim, and not its substance. It has been a distressing series of events, and I'm glad that it has concluded with no finding against us. Lacer said, our intention, as soon as these concerns were raised by the Secretary of State, was to adopt a well-governed process to support evidenced, principled decisions. I am grateful for the thorough work of all those involved in this investigation. I hope this will bring a clear resolution in a way that best supports all of those who serve on our advisory groups and research and innovation in the UK. That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National, on Wednesday, the 6th of March, 2024. From the News and Politics section. Scottish Independence, new group to promote creativity in Yes Movement. Article by Laura Pollock, multimedia journalist. Believe in Scotland are set to launch a group to embed cultural and creative activities in the Yes Movement. The campaign organisation will hold Creating Scotland's first event in Perth at the end of March, with a lineup including music, comedy and poetry. Activists are invited to join the event at the Royal George Hotel on Saturday, March the 30th, and start to create a vision for a better independent Scotland. The date is coordinated with the opening of the new Perth Museum, which will hold the Stone of Destiny after a £27 million redevelopment project. The Stone of Destiny will be the centrepiece of the new museum and will be free for all to view. Local activists hope that the opening of the museum will ensure high attendance at the event, which starts at 2 p.m. Scottish singer Sheena Wellington, Bruce Fumi and the Yes Band have been announced, with more to come soon. Wellington, a Scottish Traditional Music Hall of Fame member, is best known for performing the Robert Burns song A Man's a Man for All That at the opening ceremony of the Scottish Parliament in 1999. Her rendition of the Robert Burns standard was televised live and broadcast around the world. Fumi, a Perthshire-based comic and speaker, known for his videos on Scottish history and culture, will also appear at the event. Fumi, who has one Scottish and one Ghanaian parent, was named Scottish Comedian of the Year in 2014 and has some 170,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel. Believe in Scotland has said, support from a strong and diverse cultural campaign involving artists, musicians, comedians, writers and more from across Scotland is crucial to winning our independence, and that it is a key element missing from the Yes campaign at the moment. The event listing states, it has become clear that a key element missing from the independence campaign since 2014 has been the cultural side of the campaign and a creative element to our campaigning activities. Believe in Scotland wants to change that. Our campaign steering group has set up a subgroup to work towards embedding cultural and creative activities in our campaign. Creating Scotland is the first of many steps in this direction, and we hope you are keen to join us. Event tickets cost £5 each. That article was by Laura Pollock.
The National, recorded on Wednesday, 6th of March 2024. The Culture section. Back in the day, a saint and a sin lie at the heart of this Scottish town's story, by Hamish McPherson, journalist. Today I reached the 10th column in this series on ancient towns of Scotland, which I'm glad to say has received positive reviews from readers of The National. I also appear not to have offended anyone with series errors, but as always, if you think I've got something factually wrong, then please email me. I can't fix any mistake in the print edition of The National, but I can rectify matters online. I've already covered Brechin, Elgin, Falkirk, Arbroath, Ayr, Paisley, Dumbarton, Dumfries and Lanark, and still to come are Stornoway, Hamilton, Kilmarnock, St Andrews, Montrose, Forfar, Colwinning, Irvine, Renfrew and two more which are revealed below. To be included in the list of ancient towns, I set the following rules. They all have to have played a part in the history of Scotland and be ancient, which I interpret as being established as a town, usually a borough, before the Reformation in 1560. Regular readers will recall that in recent weeks I've urged anyone who wants to promote their own town for a column to contact me on nationalhamish@gmail.com, and as a result of readers' pleas, today I'm going to write about Tain, while next week I will feature Haddington. My interest in Tain was sparked by Malcolm Anderson, who emailed me to say, "I'm no historian, but I would suggest you include the Royal Borough of Tain in your series. This is Scotland's oldest royal borough. Several Scottish kings have made repeated pilgrimages, and if my schoolboy memory serves me well, King Robert the Bruce sent his wife and family to the chapel in Tain for sanctuary, but the Earl of Moray ignored the sanctuary, captured Bruce's family and burnt the chapel. The ruins remain." As I say, most of the above comes from my memory of history lessons at Tain Royal Academy, but worth a little confirmation from yourself. It's good to know that Scottish history was taught at the Academy, as so many other schools in Scotland had a curriculum which minimised the subject if they included it at all. Malcolm is mostly correct in what he writes, apart from the fact that it was the Earl of Ross and not Moray who had broke the sanctuary rules, one of the saddest incidents in Scottish history, which we'll explore at length in this column today. Readers will also know that as a writer about history, I always depend on the accounts of local historians, and Tain is no different, as I'm very much relying on 1882 work, researches into the history of Tain, earlier and later by local minister Reverend William Taylor. It can be seen on that excellent website electricscotland.com, to which I'm always grateful. Tain is indeed the oldest of the royal boroughs, if you believe local claims. Remember, very little is certain about Scotland in medieval times. Situated in the ancient county of Rossshire, on the south side of the Dornoch Firth, Tain either gets its name from the River Tain, the word coming from an ancient Celtic description meaning flow, or from the Norse word ting, a meeting place, the Vikings having raided the area and liked it so much some settled around what became Rossshire in the 9th century. I prefer the Celtic derivation as the Picts undoubtedly settled here in the first millennium, by the end of which the local people, comprising both Picts and Scots, joined under one monarch, were devoutly Christian. That religious connection is a defining factor for Tain, because it was in the immediate environs of the town that Saint Duthac, or Duthus, was born. There's been an ongoing dispute about the origins of the saint, particularly the date he was born. Some have placed him as late as the 12th or 13th century, but I very much prefer the local tradition that he was born before the year 1000. The Gaelic name of Tain shows just how important was the connection with the saint. Balladuich means Duthoc's town, and he undoubtedly made a huge impression on the church in both Scotland and Ireland as a confessor and preacher. Unlike other locations in the north of Scotland, there are no records of any kind about Tain before the 11th century. No major archaeological finds were ever made, though Pictish stones were extant in the area. But in 1066, Tain gained the royal charter which enables it to claim to be the oldest royal borough. Taylor concluded, "In this neighbourhood no one of the races absolutely prevailed. Hence I think it came to pass that neither Pictish, Gaelic, nor Norse history or tradition proved strong enough to outlive, as in many other parts of Scotland, one or other did outlive, that chaotic period of bloodshed and social revolution, and that it is only in the 11th century that the history of Tain can be said to commence, when the Norse domination in this quarter having come to an end, and the province of Moray and Ross to which it belonged, having been conclusively annexed to the Kingdom of Scotland. It received from King Malcolm Canmore its constitution as a free Scottish town. It was a lot more than that, because King Malcolm, in honour of Dúthac, gave Tain a girth of sanctuary in 1066. That would make sense, because Dúthac's death at Armagh in Ireland is reported by Irish chronicles as having taken place on March 8, 1065, and Canmore would definitely have wanted to lay an early claim to the veneration of a holy man who was acclaimed as a saint upon his death. In 1966, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, opened a rose garden in Tain to mark the 900th anniversary of the Charter, and that's good enough evidence for me of the truth of the Canmore Charter, for no one would have dared hoax that formidable Scottish woman. A shrine and chapel were duly erected and named for St Dúthac, while the sanctuary girth was completely believed. Anyone fleeing the pursuers, even law authorities, could take up residence inside the bounds of the sanctuary and would be protected by the church. Most people who sought sanctuary were eventually sent into exile, but some people lived and died in sanctuary. With its royal trading privileges in sanctuary, the town of Tain grew steadily. Taylor wrote, "We can easily imagine that the combined advantages which have been mentioned would operate in the following centuries to give its importance and prosperity. As the market town and centre of trade for a large district, as a seat of magisterial authority and law, as a place of considerable ecclesiastical importance, a resort of pilgrims, and a sanctuary of refuge for the distressed, it would not only obtain a permanent population of its own, but would besides attract many visitors from the surrounding neighbourhood." Local tradition was that the body of St Dúthac was perfectly preserved at Armagh until his remains were moved to Tain in 1253, where even more numerous pilgrims came to pray at his grave. What is left of the ancient chapel can still be seen near the town's golf club. Tain was also the scene of the most egregious breach of sanctuary in Scottish history. In 1306, having been crowned king at Scone, Robert the Bruce sent his family north to escape the clutches of the English army, who were in hot pursuit of him. With his brother Nigel in charge, the king's wife Elizabeth de Burgh, his daughter Marjorie, his sisters Mary and Christina, and Isabella Macduff, Countess of Buchan, took refuge in Kildrummy Castle in Aberdeenshire. As the English advanced north, it was decided that the women would seek sanctuary at Tain, with Orkney, then a Norwegian province, their ultimate destination. Nigel Bruce and his men stayed at Kildrummy to allow the women to escape. Nigel's courage cost him his life. He was captured and then hanged, drawn, and quartered. Meanwhile, William, the second Earl of Ross, one of the many nobles in Scotland who flip-flopped their loyalties during the Wars of Independence, intervened grievously. He was a relative of the common family, who thus had no love for the Bruces. In early 1307, he was a supporter of England's King Edward I. He would die in July that year, and he duly rode to Tain and broke the sanctuary, capturing the Bruce women. They were either then sent into English convents, or placed in cages in the walls of English castles, kept in captivity by Edward II until after the Battle of Bannockburn. The breach of sanctuary was soon regretted by the Earl of Ross, who joined the Bruce camp, and later attached his seal to the Declaration of Arbroath in 1320. His son Hugh, the third Earl, became a favourite of King Robert and married his sister Matilda, or Maud. The concept of sanctuary at Tain survived into the 15th century when, according to Taylor, in 1427, a bandit chief called Thomas McNeill of Creagh pursued an enemy laird called Mowat into the sanctuary and burned the chapel to the ground with several men trapped inside. McNeill's actions were so offensive that his own brother turned him in to King James I. St Dúthac's remains were then moved again, this time to the collegiate church in the town, perhaps confusingly named St Dúthac. After Dúthac was accepted onto the official list of saints, Tain became a major place of pilgrimage, and King James IV made an annual journey to the shrine at Tain, possibly in penance for his role in the regicide of his father, or because he had a mistress conveniently located nearby. Pilgrimages effectively ceased long before the remains of St Dúthac were lost after the Reformation of 1560, but religion continued to play an important part in the affairs of Tain. When King James VI became King James I of England, he basically wanted to amalgamate the Presbyterian Kirk with the Episcopalian Church of England. Reverend John Munro, minister at Tain, was one of the famous seven dissenters who defied the king. He was sentenced to internal exile in Kintyre, but soon returned to Tain to care for his flock. The Scottish Privy Council warned the council and people of Tain against harbouring Munro, but the town sheltered him for 20 years until his death in 1630. In 1650, Taine played a small part in the defeat of the great royalist general James Graham, the Marquis of Montrose, whose forces were gathered at Carbisdale across the Dornoch Firth in Sutherland. The army of the Covenanting government in Edinburgh was sent north, and the horse troops gathered at Taine. From there they moved to confront Montrose and his clansmen in a one-sided slaughter which saw Montrose flee, only to be captured and executed in Edinburgh. Oliver Cromwell showed his gratitude to Taine during his conquest of Scotland. Parliament troops were quartered in the town in 1656, and they did so much damage that much of the population fled. Even more destruction was to come 40 years later, when a devastating fire razed many of the dwellings in the town. That meant a lot of rebuilding, which is why there are so many fine edifices from that era in Taine, including the splendid Tolbooth. The 19th century Maitland family of architects are largely responsible for the distinctive look of Taine. Taine prospered as a market town and administrative centre in the 19th century, and the Industrial Revolution largely passed it by. The town does have one nearby famous business, the Glenmorangie Distillery. Like the town itself, it's well worth a visit. By Hamish McPherson, The National, recorded on Wednesday, 6th of March 2024. The Culture Section. Scottish Independence, new group to promote creativity and yes movement, by Laura Pollock, multimedia journalist. Believe in Scotland are set to launch a group to embed cultural and creative activities in the yes movement. The campaign organisation will hold Creating Scotland's first event in Perth at the end of March, with a lineup including music, comedy and poetry. Activists are invited to join the event at the Royal George Hotel on Saturday, March 30, and start to create a vision for a better independent Scotland. The date is coordinated with the opening of the new Perth Museum, which will hold the Stone of Destiny after a £27 million redevelopment project. The Stone of Destiny will be the centrepiece of the new museum and will be free for all to view. Local activists hope that this opening of the museum will ensure high attendance at the event, which starts at 2 p.m. Scottish singer Sheena Wellington, Bruce Fumi and the Yes Band have been announced, with more to come soon. Wellington, a Scottish Traditional Music Hall of Fame member, is best known for performing the Robert Burns song A Man's a Man for A' That at the opening ceremony of the Scottish Parliament in 1999. Her rendition of the Robert Burns standard was televised live and broadcast around the world. Fumi, a Perthshire-based comic and speaker, known for his videos in Scottish history and culture, will also appear at the event. Fumi, who has one Scottish and one Ghanaian parent, was named Scottish Comedian of the Year in 2014 and has some 170,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel. Believe in Scotland has said support from a strong and diverse cultural campaign involving artists, musicians, comedians, writers and more from across Scotland is crucial to winning our independence, and that is a key element missing from the Yes campaign at the moment. The event listing states, it has become clear that a key element missing from the independence campaign since 2014 has been the cultural side of the campaign and a creative element to our campaigning activities. Believe in Scotland wants to change that. Our campaign steering group has set up a subgroup to work with towards embedding cultural and creative activities in our campaign. Creating Scotland is the first of many steps in this direction, and we hope you're keen to join us. Event tickets cost £5 each. By Laura Pollock.
The National, Thursday the 7th of March, from the News section. Police Scotland backs inquiry into Emma Caldwell murder investigation. Police Scotland has backed holding a public inquiry into the investigation of the murder of Emma Caldwell. Chief Constable Joe Farrell released a statement after meeting her family on Wednesday, saying they were let down by policing in 2005 and apologised. It is important that Emma's family and the public get answers to the many questions they have, she added. I therefore support the family's calls for a public inquiry. I absolutely commit that Police Scotland will fully participate in any further proceedings. It puts further pressure on First Minister Hamza Yousaf to call for an inquiry, coming just a day after Justice Secretary Angela Constance said she and the First Minister were very open to the call for the public inquiry after meeting the family themselves and promising that a quick decision would be made. Ian Packer, 51, was jailed for life with a minimum of 36 years after being found guilty at the High Court in Glasgow last week of murdering 27-year-old Caldwell in 2005. 11 counts of rape against 9 women and 21 further charges, including sexual assaults. We have reflected and learned from the initial investigation and subsequent reinvestigation, Farrell continued in this statement. Significant changes have been made in recent years to improve our organisational culture and our response, particularly in respect of investigative structures, victim care and processes to these type of crimes. Our Violence Against Women and Girls strategy demonstrates our absolute commitment to tackling the violence and abuse that disproportionately affects women and girls. I am also committed to relentlessly improving how we respond to and serve the public, and to ensuring officers and staff uphold our values and help to deliver justice for victims. Speaking after the meeting between Farrell and Caldwell's mother, Margaret Caldwell lawyer Amar Anwar said they were grateful that the Chief Constable has stated she fully supports their demands for a public inquiry. That is the only way that the Police Service of Scotland and former officers can ever truly be held to account, he said. Had it not been for Margaret Caldwell's tireless campaigning, then any hope of justice would have been buried forever. We know Packer carried out rapes, sexual offences and assaults some 19 times after Emma's murder in 2005. Should a public inquiry be announced in the coming days, the Chief Constable promised the family that Police Scotland would fully cooperate. But the family sought an assurance that any officers, past or present, called to give evidence will be denied the right to immunity from prosecution. If they have nothing to hide, then they have nothing to fear from speaking with candour. If they broke the law, then of course they must face the prospect of imprisonment. That was an article by James Walker. The National, Thursday the 7th of March, from the news section. Sauchie Hall Street works delayed amid discovery of new issues. Glasgow City Council last revealed that the 5.7 million revamp of the city's Sauchie Hall Street, which was set to be completed in late summer, will now be finished by November-December. The local authority said the reason for the delay is due to the discovery of issues with underground utilities, leading to elements of the design being amended. The council has now said the design amendment work has now been completed and construction works have resumed, which will result in an increased level of activity in the area over the next few weeks. Originally, the project started on Wednesday, September 27, 2023. Titled the Sauchie Hall Precinct and Cambridge Street Avenue Project, the precinct will connect Sauchie Hall Avenue at Rose Street and stretch to West Nile Street. The connecting Cambridge Street Avenue will reach Cowcaddens Road. The avenue is part of a wider network of new, attractive, accessible, safe, sustainable and easily maintained routes through the city centre being delivered by the Glasgow City Region Deal funded programme. As part of the work, roads, pavements and footways on the streets will be reconstructed, with new curbing, traffic signals, 40 new street trees, rain gardens and street lighting features of the work. A spokesperson for Glasgow City Council said the work currently taking place at Cambridge Street and Sauchie Hall Street will, when complete, significantly improve the roads, pavements and footways there, with cycle paths, new lighting and new street trees, more than were in place before, amongst the features to be introduced. We are very aware of the disruption this work can bring and its impact on the appearance of the area, but when all the work is complete, the environment on Cambridge Street and this part of Sauchie Hall Street will be far more attractive for everyone who visits the area. Forthcoming projects and proposals on Socky Hall Street and the streets close to it will help to regenerate one of our greatest and most famous thoroughfares. This is an article by Ben Waddle. The National, Thursday the 7th of March, from the news section. Scottish Government reacts to spring budget as spending cuts expected. The Scottish Government has branded new Tory spending plans a betrayal of public services amid grim predictions of spending cuts. Finance Secretary Shona Robison accused the UK Government of providing not a single penny more for investment in Scotland, and she raised concerns there was a no detail on where cuts will fall. Announcing the spring budget on Wednesday, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt committed the government to increasing day-to-day public spending by 1%. But a leading expert has warned this will result in major cuts across the public sector, except in protected areas. Paul Johnson, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies think tank, said because there were bigger increases nailed in for health, defence and childcare, other parts of the state would need to be trimmed. He said his calculations said this would result in cuts worth £20 billion per year until 2028 in the unprotected areas. Reacting to the budget, Robison said public services up and down the UK are in real need of investment and they're being sacrificed to deliver unsustainable tax cuts. It comes after the Chancellor announced he was trimming national insurance payments by 2%, to be funded in part by increased duties on vapes and tobacco, as well as a controversial extension of the North Sea oil and gas windfall tax. Robison added, "Today's UK spring budget is nothing short of a betrayal of public services across the UK. Our hope had been the Chancellor would have eased pressures on services, not least by providing more funding for capital. This would have helped support our NHS and the delivery of more affordable housing, but it would also have created jobs and economic growth, as well as helping secure a just transition to net zero. Where more support is desperately needed for public services and infrastructure, for greater cost of living measures, and for money to aid our efforts to reduce carbon emissions, Scotland has been badly let down by the UK government." She raised concerns about a lack of capital funding, which is spent on major state investments in things like building new infrastructure. "Today's statement provides not a single penny more for capital funding," she added. And the Barnett consequentials from health that were signalled by the Chancellor are actually less than the in-year health consequentials of 2023-24 and less than what is needed to address the pressures we face. "I can guarantee that the Scottish Government will not be passing on this UK Government cut to our NHS. The National Insurance cut fails to offset the crippling effects of the cost of living crisis. There is also little detail of the spending cuts needed to pay for it. Even before today's spring budget, the Institute for Government described the UK government's spending plans as a fantasy, with no detail on where cuts will fall. Today's statement merely adds to that, according to the UK government's own financial watchdog, the Office for Budget Responsibility. The Treasury may not even have the headroom available that today's commitments are based on." This was an article by Hamish Morrison.
This is from The National on Thursday, 7th March 2024. From the Culture section. Scottish City unveils huge Botticelli recycled mural by Aaron Burns Lees. A huge mural made from over 30,000 bottle caps has been unveiled in Glasgow today, inspired by Italian artist Sandro Botticelli. The 25-foot-tall artwork, appropriately named Botticelli, was commissioned by the supermarket Lidl to celebrate 253,000 containers of PET plastic and aluminium recycled through the brand's return scheme pilot that launched in February. The giant mural, Turning Trash into Treasure, reimagines early Renaissance painter Botticelli's famous Birth of Venus, and is designed to encourage more shoppers and passers-by to play their part in reducing plastic pollution. Lidl teamed up with renowned mural artist Smug and Yardworks, the graffiti programme at SWG3 in Glasgow's West End, Scotland's leading multidisciplinary arts venue, to complete the project. Laura Froud, Engagement and Participation Lead at SWG3 Glasgow, said, "It's been a pleasure working alongside Lidl, Sam, Smug and the wider team here at SWG3 to create Botticelli over the past month. The mural looks fantastic and is testament to the talented team of artists and students who were able to make art from waste bottle tops." Beyond the mural, the partnership has also seen investment into our Yardworks programme and Street Arts Festival, which will take place May 4th and 5th. The artwork is embellished in parts with a mix of bottle caps due to be recycled, as well as bottle caps already recycled through the scheme. Marco Ivone, Lidl's Regional Director for Scotland, said, "Since launching last month, we've had an overwhelming response to our pilot return scheme, and Botticelli is an opportunity for us to give something back to the Glasgow community. We know our customers share our passion for sustainability and saving money, and we hope even more people take advantage of the schemes as we continue to invest in ways to ensure recycling is as convenient as possible." Lidl's return scheme pilot launched in February and will run until August. Shoppers receive a 5p reward for each eligible item that they return, which can either be redeemed against their weekly shop or donated to the supermarket's charity partner, the SDV Children's Appeal. The supermarket anticipates the trial scheme will result in a minimum 10.5 tonnes of plastic and aluminium material being recycled each month, with the material set to be retained and used to create new plastic and aluminium products. You can find out more about the scheme and how you can donate online. To visit the Botticelli mural, head to 100 East Vale Place, Glasgow, G38QG. That article was by Aaron Burns-Lees.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Tune Review and to tell your friends about our service.